there are not figures on the left who are willing to fund these type of projects like they are on the right.
It's Friday, October 13th, 2017. That's right, Friday the 13th, everybody. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I'm usually talking to our capital muckraker-in-chief, Fionn Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Sean is not going to be here today, though, folks. So for those of you who tune in for Sean, you can click me off now. But Sean had a funeral to go to. I won't get into his business. I'll let him talk about it next week if he wants to. But Sean will be back next week. We might have a little delayed release next week. I'm going to have to figure that out. I've got some things I got to get done earlier in the day. But we shall see. This week's show, Trump continues the assault on Obamacare through what Rick Smith liked to call the cut, gut, and punish model of right-wing politics. In the absence of legislative action to repeal the ACA, Trump is doing everything he can to give it a slow, painful death. Millions of people will be at risk. Also, Trump's new federal rule will let employers opt out of having to cover birth control in their health insurance plans, well, only if God tells them not to. That actually literally broke right after we got done recording last week. Crazy. Trump looks like he's about had enough paying, having to pay attention to Puerto Rico. I guess the whole paper towel thing is, not interesting anymore. Representative Scott Perry's got his back on that one. He takes to CNN to basically say that, there's nobody dying in Puerto Rico. What's your problem? Crazy. And it turns out that the FBI was onto the problem of extremists ahead of the violence in Charlottesville. One problem, it was that they had the wrong extremists. The report that went out just days before Charlottesville, the FBI was laser focused on what they saw as the emerging threat of, wait for it, black identity extremists. Their words. Rick Smith aired a special on Janus versus AFSCME, the Supreme Court case that will likely gut public sector unions. Time to get up to speed on that one, folks. And what happens if the right-wing media wins? That's the title of a recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review by McKay Coppins, who was interviewed on the Majority Report this week, and that's got us thinking again about the need to build progressive media networks and fast. We'll take a peek at the right's infrastructure and wonder why the left does not invest in our own media in the way they do on the right. We'll talk Bradley Foundation, Hillsdale College, and even attempts... This just blows my mind. To flood student government elections with billionaire cash. That's right, student government, folks. The next domino to fall, I guess. And today's last call, we've got space news and beer, of course. Scientists think that we may have a ninth planet after all. It's thought to be about 10 times more massive than Earth and about 20 times farther out from the sun than Neptune. Also, this early this morning, an asteroid got cozy with Earth. Say hello and goodbye to 2012 TC4. Free Will Brewing has got a much-anticipated sour release today. Today at 3 p.m. at both locations of Free Will, they're releasing Wild Hack, Alfodra and Barrel-Aged Sour Brown with Blueberries, and Industrio Rustique, Alfodra and Rum Barrel-Aged Funky Belgian-Style Dark Ale. I can't wait to get over there today. We've been waiting for these for a while. And then I should give the shout out to Chris out there, too, Chris W., one of our members. Chris Sean is stopping by later on today, and he's going to bring something back for you. Just saying. And Pizza Boy also released its Pumpkin Sunny Side Up on Tuesday. Cans only, folks. I know there's a lot of pumpkin haters out there, but I'm not one of them. And tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. I'll be there giving the weekly resistance report. Well, actually, not this week. I won't be there for the resistance report this week. But do tune into the Rick Smith Show. It's becoming that much more important to support his work any chance you can. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, no worries. Go to thericksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar. I also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Inside 254 Podcast and apologize. I think I referred to them last week as 234 or something like this. I don't know where my head was at. It's the Inside 254 Podcast. They're doing some great stuff over there on gender, race, and labor. A couple of their recent episodes, for example, was the F word, feminism. And one on working families and new labor department changes, stochastic terrorism, and a call to action for millennials. They're doing great stuff. Check it out, folks. And if you need a break from politics for a bit, then check out Old Man and Skinny Guy podcast. It's a great gaming podcast. They interview people from across the gaming communities and have a load of fun. It's like the perfect thing. And both those actually come out every Friday, so just like ours. You pack up for your weekend, folks. And so if you like what you hear at Raging Chicken, you like the work that we're doing over at Raging Chicken Press, you want to support and help build this progressive media infrastructure, well, you can become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and look up for the support and membership tab. You can also click on the show notes here today. Click become a member and you're on your way. Or, look, you don't want to become a member right now, okay? You want to just make a one-time donation. You know, you don't like having those recurring payments? Okay, you can do it all at once. You just go to the same place, RagingChickenPress.org, and click on Donate. And we still are running our back-to-school special through the end of the month, through the end of October, that is. If you join Raging Chicken Press at the $10 a month level, we'll send you a copy of Mark Bray's new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. We'll also send you, if you don't want that, we'll send you the Raging Chicken Stay Woke coffee mug, which I'm actually drinking out of right this moment. And if you don't want either of those, but I still have got like one or two copies left of Naomi Klein's No Is Not Enough, awesome book, we can send you that. So just let us know. We'll send you that and some swag. Just join at the $10 a month level, folks. Whoo, boy, let me tell you, it's one of these days. It is one of these days. So, so Sean's not here, so I'm just going to run through some things, run through some stuff in the show. It's probably going to run a little shorter than it usually is when Sean and I get going, but, so one, as I said, right at the get-go, what we saw this past week, I mean, it might as well have been a healthcare assault week. Like I said, right at the top of the show, at the beginning of our next cycles, like literally right after we got done recording, cause it was on the, you know, editing the podcast and there pops the news that, Trump has just basically made it, easier, to go and cut, you know, birth control. And basically what it did is like, you know, again, this is something that the right has been pushing for a while. If you remember the Hobby Lobby case from last year about, you know, can a corporation basically say that it's got some, you know, objection to covering birth control because of religious reasons? Well, Trump has basically put that into a rule now. And it announced that it was be effectively immediately and it would make easier for employers to stop covering birth control. It's pretty crazy. Now, that was all the reason why that was an issue to begin with, or why he's even doing it to begin with, is because that was part of Obamacare, right? He put in a federal requirement for that employers must include birth control coverage in their insurance plans, to offer health insurance. Not no more. Now it's pretty much, you know, all they got to say is like, God told me so. And that's it. You know, no birth control for you. And this is kind of what we're seeing this week. I mean, this, you know, the Congress could not get Obamacare repealed. They could not get the ACA repealed. So what are they doing? They're basically giving it a slow, painful death. And that's the only way I can see it. And I think it's really important for people to understand that's what's going on here, is that, you know, they're basically, if they can't do it through the direct means, Trump is using all the tools he has of the presidency to basically, you know, bleed it out. Right. So, for example, so you have the health, you have the birth control coverage, right? That gets pulled out, right? So that it covers less. The rules that were announced yesterday, are basically going to defund big sections of the Affordable Care Act, right? So, for example, there were these subsidies. They were kind of these cost sharing reductions. That was basically, you know, if you're going to mandate coverage, right, and everybody has got to kind of come in, the health insurance industries are basically, you know, that means they're going to be paying more out of pocket, right, that potentially healthcare costs could go up because you could have more sick people that are going to be entering into the exchanges, especially because, you know, the insurance companies can't kick people off the insurance anymore for, you know, pre-existing conditions and that kind of stuff. What we're finding now is that, so how Obamacare basically worked, right, was that basically instead of being a single payer system, right, where you'd have, or having a public option where that would be the kind of, say, the government backed program, a kind of Medicare for all kind of program, they did this thing where they wanted to keep the private insurance companies, and they said, well, listen, we know it's going to cost you more, but to get them to buy in, the government basically subsidized those their losses, right, to make sure that they would offer these plans, right? Now, again, we could get into the whole discussion about this being the bad idea from the beginning, right, about basically believing that, you know, or investing into these private healthcare, like, corporations that seek to profit off of our, like, Medicare, our medical care. And that's the problem at the core of it. Let's be frank about it. But in the short term, okay, so they did this subsidy thing, right? So that was a way that was going to make it more affordable for people to get insurance, and then insurance companies weren't going to just kind of jack up prices there. Well, now we're going to see basically the elimination of about $7 billion in annual subsidies. And this is going to be huge. So what's going to happen almost immediately, you're going to find that these health insurance companies are just going to pull out of the exchanges. I mean, there's no way. So, you know, without that incentive, they're just not going to offer those plans. So there's that one way. And, you know, again, then there's going to be fewer people, and the people that do go in, and that's the only way that they could get insurance is through these exchanges. They're going to have to pay more money, right, which is going to make it less affordable, which is going to make people hate Obamacare even more than they're already do. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, very, very happy to have insurance. They're not so happy with the cost of it. It's not as affordable as it was promised and that kind of stuff. There's still people without insurance. But it was a huge step forward, and that is being walked back pretty fast. The other side of it, too, as well, is, you know, if you remember, another aspect of Obamacare was that it basically kind of like was a patient protection act, right? It basically said that, if you have insurance, that if you go out and you buy insurance, it has to meet some minimum requirements, right? That you have to, you know, it has to cover pre-existing conditions. It has to cover birth control. It has to cover prescription drugs. You know, you can't have lifetime caps on it, right? All those things that the insurance industries were doing to maximize their profit, right, under the Affordable Care Act, they could no longer do that, right? Well, yep, slowly, there you go. What Trump just did also on Thursday was basically removed a bunch of those and basically allowed for certain groups. So basically allows for kind of businesses to group together and to form some kind of like coalition to buy health insurance. And those folks no longer have to meet those minimum requirements. So you take that as number one, right? So that they can actually just offer health insurance that, you know, you basically get to go to 4 visits to your doctor and that's it. And it doesn't cover hospital stays and, you know, whatever it might be. It'd be like insurance in name only. But he also wants to have these things be able to sell them across state lines without any kind of specific licensing. right? So basically what that means now is that you're going to have corporations and businesses and universities and all this stuff are going to be hunting for the lowest cost health care that they can get, and they can do that across state lines. So if New York State, for example, right, or Pennsylvania for that matter, wants to have fairly strong rules in place that if you're going to have, you know, going to be your insurance company that you're based in Pennsylvania, you have to kind of meet these requirements to make sure that people are covered in health care. Well, under these new rules, basically you say, well, okay, that's what they have in Pennsylvania, but down there in, I don't know, Arkansas, right, there's a you know, a healthcare company that, you know, has health insurance that is, I don't know, a fifth of the cost, right? So that's going to save us here in Pennsylvania, save our university, save our corporation a whole ton of money by having that cheap healthcare. Now, of course, it's, again, healthcare in name only, right? It's not actual healthcare. It's just maybe covers four doctor's visits and, you know, a few procedures, has extraordinarily high deductibles, won't cover your, you know, hospital stays, won't cover pregnancy, won't cover family leave, all that kind of stuff. But it's cheap. And it's called health insurance, right? That's kind of what's going on. So, you know, again, double assault on the ACA this week. It is not looking good. And, you know, it's only going to be a matter of time until, you know, the ACA is just kind of bled out. You know, the Republicans right now keep on saying the ACA is failing and, you know, it's going to fail. We're just going to let it fail. Well, no. They're not just letting it fail. They're going after it and they're causing it to fail. So, you know, you have to have that in your mind every step of the way, is that what the Republicans are doing right now, what Trump is doing right now, they're systematically gutting all the pillars upon which Obamacare is standing. So it's going to make it kind of cover less. It's going to be less affordable, and people are going to be frustrated, and rightly so. So again, back to the single payer stuff, right? I mean, that's really kind of where we need to go. But that was quite a crazy week on healthcare. Other news there too, as well, is I don't know if you saw what Trump was saying about Puerto Rico. He's basically saying, you know, at some point, you know, we've got to, you know, I don't know why we're giving them money anymore, because at some point they got to stand on their own, right? You know, it's only so much that we're going to give. He's basically using, right, the worst kind of right wing talking points when it comes to welfare, right, when it comes to government programs, and applying it to Puerto Rico. He's essentially blaming Puerto Rico for its own destruction, and basically saying that, you know what, you know, we're not going to give them handouts anymore. They're going to have to do it on their own. I mean, it was some of the cruelest kind of comments you could possibly issue, especially coming from the president of the United States. I mean, it's pretty clear. Yeah, that's just nuts. Now, and the local connection, of course, is that Scott Perry, Representative Scott Perry, took to CNN to basically back Trump 100%. And basically denying that people are actually dying in Puerto Rico because of lack of water and electricity. Of course, yes, what Scott Perry and what Trump want to focus on is like, you don't need to kind of have a light on in order to live. Right. Yeah, sure. That's fine. That's true. If you're sitting there and, you know, you're healthy and you're fine and you just have to, you know, light a candle or something like that, you know, to be able to read your book by or something. I don't know. But if you're on dialysis, right, if you're kind of require, you know, transfusions in the hospital, if you require any kind of electric power in order to stay alive, you're done. Right. Hospitals are already reporting in Puerto Rico that, you know, they've been running now for weeks now on portable generators. You know, portable generators are not meant to be a main power supply. So some of those generators are beginning to fail, of course. So I don't know. It's been a crazy situation. So you've got Puerto Rico. You've got healthcare attacks. Like, and you know, and then you know, it just doesn't stop. One of the things I just do want to mention quickly, and like I said, and we're going to have a kind of relatively short show today, is that I think it'd be a good idea for people to check out Rick Smith's show on Janus versus AFSCME last night. Janus versus AFSCME basically is that Supreme Court case we've talked about before on the show that is going after what's called fair share fees for public sector unions. So fair share fees are, you know, basically this. I've explained this before, but, you know, it can't hurt to repeat because people just don't know what this stuff is, right? I mean, and, you know, if you don't have a union, right, and union density is some of the lowest it's ever been since you had since World War II at least, if you're not a union shop, you don't really know what these things are. But fair share fees are basically saying it's like this. It's like, okay, under law, right, if a union is bargaining or negotiating a contract at a particular workplace, right? So I work at Kutztown University. It's part of the state system of higher education. Our contract covers all 14 state university schools, right? So the union, ABSCUF in my case, negotiates a contract, okay? So now that contract applies to everybody who's working there, right? So if you are a member of the union, you're covered under the contract. Right. If you can't stand unions, right, and you don't want to be a member of the union, or you have some sort of, you know, God told you not to be part of a union, right, which is weird. But any of that stuff, right, you don't have to be part of the union, right, and you're still covered under that contract, right? So you don't have to go negotiate your personal deal or something like that, right? The university, right, in our case, doesn't have the right to also now pay you less, right, or pay you on a different scale or not offer you health insurance. No, you get all those things, right, that the union has negotiated for and fought for. And if the university, right, if an administration starts to violate your rights under that contract, even if you don't like unions, right, the union has to and will – right, defend your rights under that contract. Because what essentially the union is doing, right, is it defending the contract, the terms of that contract that it helped negotiate, right? So even if you don't like them, you're still going to do this. And that's not only is that something that we do as unions, right, it's also something that is like under the law you have to. So fair share fees are basically saying, okay, look, you don't have to pay the full union dues, right? Because some union dues will go towards like different kinds of programs or stuff, or maybe things that are kind of involved with political action or something like this. Not like political action committee stuff, but, you know, lobbying or whatever it might be on behalf of the union. There's all that kind of stuff. But you do have to pay your fair share, right? So you can't be a free rider, is basically. You can't get all the benefits of the contract, right, and then just get it for free, right? That's the idea about fair share. Fair share, like, fees are the costs, right, to basically make sure that those are the costs involved with negotiating and upholding and defending the contract. Okay? So Janus, this case that's going up before, that's JANUS, Janus versus AFSCME, the case that's kind of going up before the Supreme Court, is the case that's basically wanted to say we want to get rid of fair share fees. That I don't even have to pay my fair share. No, the union still has to defend me. I still get what the union has negotiated. I get all the benefits, but I don't have to pay a dime to the union because God told me not to, right? That's the kind of idea. So I think that's a bad idea, right? I don't like the free rider whole kind of idea with stuff. But that's what's going forward. The last time that this kind of case was moving forward was the Friedrichs case. And that went through last year. And you remember right as it was about to be considered, Justice Scalia died, right? Everyone expected Friedrichs to go through that it was going to be a 5-4 decision, and fair share was going to be done, right? Now you've got Gorsuch, right? Because thanks to a Trump presidency, right? All those folks who, like, you know, just could not hold their nose and vote for Hillary Clinton out there, just remember that, or didn't vote at all. Because Trump is in office, he appointed Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, and now there's a strong 5-4 majority, and this case is expected to go by the way of Janus, and will basically eliminate the right of unions to collect fair share fees. What does that mean in practice? Well, what the expectation is that, you know, and again, some of this is on unions. right? There's a particular model of unionization that basically was kind of the business unionism, where you have union leadership kind of takes care of all the problems and does not necessarily constantly engage their members with organizing, right? Or political organizing or fighting back, right? It's more of an insider's game. The exchange is like, we'll get you a good contract. You just listen to us. We'll tell you when we need something from you. Okay, there's that part of it. So you basically have a probably at least a generation of union members who this is not true of all unions, I should say, but it is a dynamic that you will encounter over and over again, is that union leadership is not interested in mobilizing its base and kind of organizing for militant labor action. Right. So most union members are, you know, you have this kind of us versus them thing. Right. You know, I believe that, you know, we are the union. Right. Our bylaws show us it's not the people who we elect. Right. The president of our union who gets to tell us what to do. Right. It's our bylaws show it. It's our legislative assembly. Right. Our representative on our campus. It's our representative councils. Right. We get to determine the course of our union. Right. And that's kind of the democratic character, right, of the workplace. That's why I believe so strongly in unions. I believe in the democratic process. I believe in people being empowered to make decisions. Right. I don't want a boss. I don't want a union boss. And I don't want a regular boss. Right. To tell me what to do all the time. Right. It's about ground up political organizing and an activated membership. Right. That's what we should be doing. But it's been a long time, right, since unions have done that. And some of that has to do with, you know, bargains that were made after World War II, where, you know, there was a shared interest of sorts between capital and labor, at least at the level of, you know, making sure that people had decent contracts, that they got paid well, and they had health insurance, that kind of stuff. So that was there, right? You know, that was kind of one of it. Another part is that, you know, you take that on the one hand, you couple that with, you know, basically a 40-year assault on unions. I mean, you know, you had, you know, in the Reagan administration, I remember like in 1980, right, when, you know, came in and basically, you know, the air traffic controller strike, right, where Reagan came in and basically broke the union, right, and fired everybody, right? And the PATCO strike, that was a huge deal. You know, as you know, Rick Smith is always saying, it's like, you know, it was a shot heard around the boardroom. You know, I mean, that was boardrooms across the world. And that was like the signal to the world, like, OK, it's, you know, open season on unions. And it's been nonstop ever since then. And I remember, you know, my dad was a union negotiator for NYSET, which is New York State United Teachers. And I can remember, you know, I have these vague recollections of it. I remember during the time in 1980 when I was 12 at the time or something, when that strike was going on, and my dad had to go to this kind of convention or conference or something like this for NYSET. And they had, it was like to Houston or something like this. And then he had the PATCO strike and said, okay, that's it. We're not crossing picket lines. And so they had to kind of like find rides and buses and carpools and stuff like that down to Texas or something like this. For that strike, and I remember him talking about how horrendous it was and what Reagan was doing at that time. Well, and it's been like that ever since. So I think that unions have legitimately felt like they're, you know, in defensive posture. There's just different tendencies within unions, right? What do you do when you're in defense? What do you do when you're kind of like you're under assault? There's a strong impetus to try to kind of want to circle the wagons and just try to protect what you have, right? I'm of the mind that no. That's when you basically you build organization, you fight back, right? So that's it. But okay, so the whole point of that was because there's been a long time since, you know, a lot of members have been active and have been prepared to do kind of militant action in defense of what they have. What the expectation is that when Janus goes through, right, when this Supreme Court decision comes down, fair share fees will be lost. And then the expectation is that you'd have 40 to 50% of your membership leave the union, right? And why? Well, because they're just thinking about themselves, right? They're thinking about their individual interest, right, and not what it means and not how they got there to begin with. They're saying, hey, right, if I don't pay my union dues, right? That's 1% or whatever it is, you know, whatever your union is. That's 1%, 1.5%, 3%, depending on what your union is. That's 1%, 1.5%, 2% in my pocket as opposed to having to come out of my paycheck, right? So I'm just going to take my little I'm going to take mine. And what we saw during Friedrichs, right, and I mentioned this on the show last week, during Friedrichs, the Koch brothers basically funded a massive campaign ahead of that Supreme Court decision by sending flyers to union members that said, you know, give yourself a raise, right, leave the union, right, because they were fully expecting that to move forward. So that's what we're going to face. So what does that mean? Is that you talk about, you know, this is AFSCME, public sector union. So if you look at the state of Pennsylvania, public sector unions like AFSCME could face a 40% reduction of membership, right? And 40% reduction of membership is there. That means a 40% reduction of revenue, right? And, you know, that's the nitty gritty of it. You know, very often on the left and progressives, we don't like to talk about money. We think money, talk about money is dirty or something like this, right? That we're supposed to just do it for the good of things. And, you know, again, I get it. Yes, that's true. But we have to be able to sustain our institutions as well, right? And which we're going to talk a little about that in a second segment. And that's kind of what we're looking at. You know, we're looking at, say, a 40% reduction of revenue coming in. So you've got AFSCME, you've got my union, ABSCUF. Right, for the state system of higher education, you've got teachers' unions. You've got SEIU represents a tremendous number of public sector workers, and that could be completely lost. And why are people going after this so strong? Like Janice, look, this is what happened. It's like, you know, the billionaire, the Koch brothers, and all their kind of their ilk. They have been after this for a long time, and what they've been doing is they've been funding these lawsuits. Right, because they recognize the only countervailing power to their organized money, right, has been organized labor. Right, organized labor has been like the foot soldiers, like on the left, right, and even the center left, right. The Democratic Party, for all its you know talk about, they don't have the on the ground organization. They don't know how to do organizing as well as organized labor does, and they have relied upon organized labor to do the dirty work of campaigning, the going door to door, of talking to people individually, right? And look, the right wing knows this. The right wing knows that, look, if you've got organized labor and people that are prepared to get out and support candidates, right, then you're going to try to destroy that power, right, so that you can win even more, right? And that's what they've been after. And this is kind of the case that's coming forward. And, you know, we get what we elect, I guess, right? You know, we got Trump in office, and he got to support Gorsuch, and Gorsuch is completely anti-labor. And so we're going to lose this one. And for generations, this will affect generations to come. And it's going to be devastating. So the real question is, what do we do now, right? And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, suggest tune into the Rick Smith show. And if you click in the show notes here, he had a special. He was talking to kind of a teamster from Washington State, I believe, and kind of answering questions about what do we do in the face of Janus, right? How do we organize? And the best thing is that, you know, I think that there are a lot of folks especially on the kind of more militant end of the labor, or more politically, you know, aware, people more interested in kind of grassroots unionism, like fight back unionism, are basically, you know, are front and center. Say, we need to organize, we need to organize, we need to organize. I think that's the only thing that is going to kind of get the power back in the labor movement. And, you know, I'd hate to think this way, because I just don't think this way normally, but I hate to think that this is what it's going to take to get a lot of folks with an organized labor off their asses and into the streets again, right? And I don't mean just for particular protests, right? I mean fight back labor, right? What brought the power in the labor movement to begin with, right? And I always say to my friends in Pennsylvania, my labor friends in Pennsylvania, where, you know, they get concerned about, you know, whether or not we should strike and, you know, are there going to be, you know, fallouts of it, or what's the legality of it? And they always want to play, you know, what's the legal limit? You know, what am I allowed to do? Right. Well, you know, labor never got anywhere by starting from that question. What am I allowed to do? Right. The question has got to be, what do you want? right? Nobody's going to give you anything. You've got to take it. That's the way it works, right? That there's no, like, you know, glorious king that is going to be all, like, you know, feeling warm and fuzzy inside and wanting to give you what you want, right? Or kind of help out your, you know, give you good health insurance or all this stuff. We should have learned that from Obama, right? When everybody kind of mobilized to get Obama in there, then they went home because they thought, you know, King Obama was going to take care of everything, right? And, of course, that didn't happen, right? So it's not going to happen that way. We got to organize, and we've got to put pressure, and we've got to gain power to kind of take, you know, take it back. And at this point, we're taking back not just, like, you know, organized power in the workforce, like in the workplace. We're talking about our democracy, right? We're talking about, like, baselines of kind of civil action. We're talking about defending our communities, our children, our healthcare, right? We're basically, you know, it's all hands on deck right now, folks. And I think that's just what we got to do. So. Anyways, I'm just going to keep on going on here. The one thing I want to mention before I go to break is that this blew my mind when it came across this last week. I mean, this is the beginning of the week. There was an article that was in let me pull it up here for a second. I just want to just read this to you, like a little piece of it for you. This was in Foreign Policy magazine. And this, you know, given what happened in Charlottesville, given the violence in Charlottesville that we actually saw, like, you know, a woman killed because of kind of, you know, these white nationalists, Nazis, fascists, right? Just absolutely incredible to me that anyways, well, we'll just go on that. But the FBI, right before the Charlottesville took place, the FBI had just kind of released this report. And in the report, it was basically calling attention to what they saw as a new threat. And that new threat was going to be what they were calling, right, black identity extremists, right? This is kind of what they were worried about. They were worried about black identity extremists. And they're basically saying that they're all concerned that, you know, look, after because so many black guys, right, were killed by police officers, that they were expecting an upscale in violence and attacks on law enforcement, armed attacks on law enforcement from these quote unquote black identity extremists. That was where all their attention was. Right. So where were they when it came to actually looking at the white identity extremists? Right. And I should say that when they talk about black identity extremists, this is the first time in FBI's history that they've used that word. Right. So this was a brand new thing that they invented so that they could actually, you know. Oh, God, I just can't even keep it together. They were so worried about, you know, the rise of the black man that they kind of had to put all their focus in there and just completely ignore the racism and the white supremacy and the neo-fascist violence that was staring them right in the face. I mean, if that doesn't say loads, I don't know what does. So, and that's where we are, folks. All the more reason that we got to fight back. Anyways, after the break, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of, say, right-wing media and kind of need to organize on the left. But this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. If you become a member of Raging Chicken, please do go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the support and membership tab. You can become a member for as little as $5 a month. It's Kevin Mahoney. We'll be back right after this break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day 33 Chilean miners were finally pulled to safety after being trapped for 69 days. Workers had been mining copper and gold 2,300 feet down at the San Jose mine near the northern city of Copiapo when the mine caved in early August. The company waited several hours to notify authorities, and rescue efforts only began 2 days later. Trapped miners initially tried to escape through ventilation shafts, but found the required ladders missing. Each route they attempted was blocked by fallen rock or threatened additional collapse. A state-owned mining company took over the rescue efforts, and soon they began. As geologist Serena Sorensen noted, prospecting for people. Initial exploratory boreholes failed to locate miners because mine shaft maps had never been updated. Rescuers had no idea whether miners were even still alive. Finally, 17 days later, the eighth borehole reached them. The miners tapped on the drill and taped notes to it, alerting rescuers above that they were indeed alive and well. Food, medicine, and other supplies were lowered down to them as rescue efforts intensified. Mini cameras were also lowered down, and miners videotaped messages of their continued ordeal. They told how they continued to search for possible escape routes and agreed to ration their limited food supplies so they could all survive. The first of three drilling plans to free the miners began. It was an international effort. The Chilean Navy consulted with NASA to design and construct the rescue pods. Throughout the entire process, rescuers worked to prevent additional cave-ins and rock falls. Finally, the extraction process began, and in less than 48 hours, all miners emerged as heroes.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Sean is not with me this week. Sean had a funeral to go to, and he will be back next week, though, so no worries. He'll be back, I swear. I didn't kind of stuff him in a closet someplace or something like that. This week I've been thinking about a lot. I was listening to the Majority Report this week. I mean, it's one of the podcasts I listen to on a fairly regular basis. I mean, you got the Majority Report, you got the Rick Smith Show, you've got Chapel Trap House. I listen to kind of mostly on occasion. Those are kind of my go-tos on a regular basis. But anyways, I think it was Wednesday. McKay Coppins was on there. McKay Coppins is a contributing writer for The Atlantic. He had a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review. It was called What If the Right-Wing Media Wins, right? And they got into discussion about the kind of increased power of kind of right-wing media right now. And it's going in a kind of even further direction. Okay. I mean, they're kind of like doubling down on the right. It's pretty disturbing. So before I get into that though, you know, the other thing I've been doing this week, and this is, my friend Seth down in Westchester is listening. So this is kind of comes out of the article that I'm working on for him that I'm actually late on. Right. This has been kicking my butt this week. But so I'm working on this article, and the article is, talking a lot about what I've been doing with Raging Chicken Press, okay, and how it connects with some of the things that I do in my scholarship and a whole bunch of things like this. But as part of this article, I was kind of trying to make a case about how far we've come in a short period of time, right? So Raging Chicken Press has been around for about 6 years, just over 6 years now. Right. And when we started right in 2011, that first month in July 2011, we've got I remember it was like 1,011 visits or something like that, or 1,101 or something like that visits. Right. I just remember all the ones. And that was like, whoa, like 1,000 people came to visit us that month. You know, that was nuts. And we're excited. And we started off just kind of doing a monthly publication, right? That quickly changed into, basically as news broke, we were writing stuff and running more consistently. But now, we've gone from that, like 1,000, right, to averaging about 15,000 visits per month. We've had a few months now. We had several months which we've broken 25,000 visits in a month, and we've had a couple that we've broken 50,000 a month. And we're on track at this point. Maybe even by the end of this year, we'll see. The end of this year, maybe beginning of 2018, we're going to hit our kind of like 1 million visit mark. That's huge. I mean, I was like kind of astonished looking back on it. Kind of looking back and trying to describe the story of what we've been doing in Raging Chicken Press, because I'm telling you, it's been nonstop. I mean, it's like the work doesn't end. But I mean, it's awesome work. Don't get me wrong. Then we added the podcast last year. So now we're doing the podcast and we've got, we're bringing on more writers. We're paying our writers now. We've got a student fellows program. I mean, you know, it's kind of sitting back in awe, kind of reflecting a little bit about what we've done. And so as part of this article, I made it a point. I said, you know, that we've, and here's the quote, right, that I was writing. It says, quote, so we've broken several stories that have been picked up and cited statewide and national news organizations, by statewide and national news organizations, including a bunch of them, right? And so then I just listed in the footnotes, you know, for examples, because if somebody's going to read it, right, you know, you can't just make a claim like that without basically showing what you're talking about. And this is just a, and I want to just take you through, this is a sampling of kind of stories that either originated with Raging Chicken Press or were cited as kind of one of the key sources by someone else, right? So let me take you through this. So, and these are not Raging Chicken stories. These are the ones that are published on our site. So these are the ones that people picked up from what we did. So here's just this is just a sampling. So these are kind of like kind of regional ones, okay? So there was an article by Steve Novak in Lehigh Valley Live called Kutztown Rejects White Nationalist Recruitment Posters on Campus. Of course, that's something that we had just recently published about. We were the one who broke that story. Will Bunch, writing down at the Philly Daily News and now Philly Live or Philly.com, quote his article on Archie Bunker, alive and well, living in Philly and voting for Trump. And that was published in 2/25/16. That was referring to an article by article that Sean wrote. Another article, Daniel Patrick Sheehan from The Morning Call, Kutztown allows guns on campus. That's a story that I broke, right, when we found out that Kutztown had changed its policies, allowing guns on campus, and they were trying to get it passed, like, under the shadow of darkness, basically, so nobody knew. We found out about it. I broke that story, and then it kind of went national. And then check this out. So we've got Jane Valencia, the quote, the article, Pennsylvania's only Latino lawmaker gets cut off arguing the English-only bill. This was published in the Huffington Post, right, on September in 2015. Ed Mazza had a piece also in the Huffington Post. GOP Scott Perry says Chesapeake Bay pollution is God's fault. Again, that comes from a story that Sean broke, right? That was published in March of 2017. Another one by Ed Mazza in the Huffington Post. GOP-backed poll-watching measure sparks voter intimidation fears in Pennsylvania. Again, something from Sean. Another article from Mother Jones, trailer park evicted to make room for fracking by Jian Cheng Warren, I think is how you say her name, or his name. That was back in June of 2012. That was actually by Wendy Lee. People remember Wendy Lee. She was writing for us right at the beginning. She was reporting on fracking. And she had gone up into this, you know, kind of been reporting on this, taking pictures about these attempts to evict all this trailer park so that the fracking industry could get to the water, right? Because it was right by a river, Riverdale, right? Then you have a piece by James Sersonsky, right? GOP's Enron-esque higher ed plan fired tenured faculty to fund student dorms. That was published in Salon in January of 2014. And that was an article that I worked with James on that was based upon my reporting about some financing schemes that were going on in the state system of higher education in Kutztown. In the we got other stuff on the pipeline. We've got other things, and you know, we even got the nod by Laura Conaway, was writing for the Matto blog, right? This article on first same-sex couple gets marriage license in Pennsylvania. We get credited in that for alerting them of that of what was going on, and I remember that kind of really distinctly because Rick Smith had the guy who was, I'm just forgetting his name right now, but the guy was down in Montgomery County who decided that, look, it's my constitutional duty. I have to follow the Constitution, and it's unconstitutional in his judgment not to marry same-sex couples. So he basically decided he was going to do that, right? So we broke that story. Rick had him booked as a guest on his show that night, but then because of the Matto picked it up from our story. They got in touch with her, right? And he canceled on Rick to go on the Matto show that night. And I remember getting Brett Vanatelli was the producer at the time, and Brett got in touch, and he's like, thanks a lot, man. That was you. Thanks. You lost my guest tonight because of you guys, right? But you know, so anyway, the point being is that, you know, you wonder sometimes, right, how much of an impact you're having doing this kind of work. Because, you know, look, frankly, it's for the most part, it's thankless, right? I mean, for the most part, it's not our primary jobs, right? I mean, you know, you can't live on virtually nothing, right? So it's not our primary jobs. You have to do this stuff on the side. You have to do it relatively sporadically, right? I mean, there's times that you can pay attention, but look, there's other times life intervenes, right? There's times in my year where things get extraordinarily busy, like when I have lots of student papers to grade or the end of the year, there's a bunch of meetings. Last year that we had a strike, right? And that took up a huge chunk of my time. So necessarily not going to be able to spend as much time with Raging Chicken. You know, same thing happens with Sean. I mean, Sean's out there. He's working full time, right? He's working full time at Pizza Boy. And he's able to kind of, you know, still do this capital reporting and so on. And I can't tell you how many progressive media sites work in the same way. And it's one of the things that's really frustrating, especially the way that, you know, I've designed Raging Chicken Press from the beginning, has been that there's a problem in new media, right? I mean, we like to look at, when I say we, I mean, there's lots of talk in the press and, you know, even in academics and stuff about new models of journalism that are emerging thanks to new media, right? And it is true, right? You know, beginning like 2000s or so, when you had the kind of the rise of the progressive blogosphere, we saw this kind of like explosion of kind of new investigative reporting and all a bunch of other stuff. And there's been extraordinary examples of this, right? I mean, you've got like The Intercept emerged as part of that whole kind of development, right? Thanks to partnership with the dude from YouTube who gave him a huge chunk of change to start that project. So you've got examples of some really good national sites, right? National progressive sites. The problem is that they're concentrated in like New York, Los Angeles, and a few in Chicago. That's it, right? So when there has been an emergence of a new kind of journalism, but they're all concentrated in these very, very, particular markets. There's this show, it's a podcast called The Pub, right? And they look at kind of public broadcasting and podcasting and new media and this kind of stuff. And it's a great podcast. And one of those podcasts, we were talking about podcasting itself, right? And basically saying one of the problems of that kind of podcast culture is that they're located in New York. So if you live in New York City and you're trying to do what we're doing here with Raging Chicken Press, right, you're right, like literally next door to a whole bunch of resources and a whole bunch of people that want to do this and want to invest in this stuff, right? So if you look at, you know, podcasts that start, even like Chapo Trap House, for example, right? It's based out of Brooklyn, right? You're connected up to those communities right away. If you're located in Southeast Pennsylvania, not in Philadelphia, right, like I am, right? If you're, you know, not in kind of one of the major cities, right, you're not near that. But exactly, these are the areas, right, where I live. You know, you look at the Kutztown area, you look at the Lehigh Valley area, you look at what's happening in Harrisburg, you look at what's happening in kind of like, you know, Frack Nation up there in the Marcellus Shale region. These are the places where their media infrastructure has been decimated by the rise of the internet, the decline of kind of, you know, classified ads as a funding source, the wholesale kind of selling off of small town newspapers to these huge kind of global conglomerates where they're trying to just turn them into profit centers. I mean, all of that has virtually gutted the kind of investigative or critical voices in those communities. Right. So when I started Raging Chicken Press, that was a commitment from the beginning, is like, look, I'm not interested in just like, you know, getting hooked up with the people in Philadelphia just for the sake of getting hooked up with the people in Philadelphia. My goal was to say, look, there's already some cool stuff happening in Philadelphia. How do we pay attention to the rest of the state? Right. I mean, you know, that became the critical part of this. Right. And there was a time when the left used to invest in its media infrastructure. Right. I remember, you know, again, this is, you know, you hear me talk about Rick Smith a lot. And that's because, you know, I've learned so much about Pennsylvania politics from this guy. He's one of the kind of most astute kind of, you know, political commentators that it's out there right now, especially, you know, that can talk about labor issues. You know, Rick, you know, he used to tell me about, I mean, I knew about some of this, but not to the extent of it. But, you know, labor unions used to have their own radio shows, right? They used to have their own newspapers, right? They used to kind of invest in those things. And that all went by the wayside, in part because of some of the stuff that I was talking about earlier, right? They didn't think that that was kind of important so much anymore. And I can tell you right now, that is so true today, too. Not just labor unions, but, you know, I have yet to crack the code on this. And maybe some of you out there, if you're listening to this, maybe you can help me with this. I've yet to crack the code on how do you get people, right? How do you get people, progressives, people on the left and liberals, to see it as important to invest in our own media infrastructure? Right. You know, and part of this, OK, you want to call this as self-serving? Fine. It's good. Right. But part of it is like my goal is like, you know, to try to make Raging Chicken Press a sustainable site. Right. And by sustainable, I mean, OK, look, we've gotten to the point now where we're bringing in, thanks to our members. Right. We've been able to and chunk of money that I put into this. We're able to cover our hosting costs. We're able to cover some promotional materials and things like this. We can cover our costs to more or less to go to the PA Progressive Summit every year in Harrisburg. And then we begin starting paying our writers. All that is awesome. Right. But when I'm talking about paying our writers, right, and I've mentioned this on the show before, is that at this point we can pay our writers a stipend of $50 for $50 a month in exchange for one article. Right. $50 a month is not sustainable. Right. For that person. Right. If that person actually wants to continue to do the work of a progressive journalist. Right. To dig in and to report on what's happening in communities of resistance. $50 a month is not going to do it. Right. It's nice. It's something in addition. But it's not going to do it. So, you know, anyways, so and if you talk, you know, and I've talked with Rick Smith about this over the years, too, as well. It's, you know, you talk to people and they get what you're saying. They agree that it's important. But those institutions and those, you know, those, say, progressive institutions don't always see it as a good investment or whatever that means to invest in progressive media. And that is exactly the opposite of what's happening on the right. Okay. And that's, you know, again, this is essentially what McKay Coppins was talking about in that piece. What if the right wing media wins? Right. The thing is, and you heard, for example, in the intro today, when you heard the intro, there was that little break, and that was Sam Cedar from this interview with McKay Coppins. But I just want to read you a little bit of the perspective that he was reporting on in this and give you a sense of what it's actually happening on the right and where things are going. Okay. So this is the beginning of the piece, and I'm quoting from McKay Coppins' piece. It was a sweltering July afternoon in the swamp. Swamp's what they call D.C. I know. I used to live there. And a small group of well-dressed conservative college students from across the country, the next generation of Megyn Kellys, George Wills, and Tucker Carlsons, was filing into an auditorium at the Heritage Foundation's Washington, D.C. headquarters. They had come to study at the feet of Breitbart News Washington editor Matt Boyle, a zealous prophet of the new right-wing media. Boyle's sermon was not about how to break into the mainstream media and steer the national news agenda towards conservative aims. It was about the end days of journalism itself. And he was not about to skimp on the fire and brimstone. Quote, "Journalistic integrity is dead," he declared. Quote, "There's no such thing anymore. So everything is about weaponizing of information," unquote. Standing behind a mahogany podium in a baggy dark suit, Boyle preached with the confidence of a true believer. In a stuttering staccato, he condemned the nation's preeminent news outlets as corrupted institutions built on a lie and a criminal, quote, "syndicate that needs to be dismantled." Boyle and his compatriots were laboring to usher in an imminent and glorious journalistic apocalypse. Quote, "We envision a day when CNN is no longer in business. We envision a day when the New York Times closes its doors. And I think that day is possible," unquote. All right? Boom. There you go. That's the agenda. Right? Now, it'd be one thing if this was a guy who was just, you know, had his little blog, right, had his version of Raging Chicken Press out there, and was saying those things, right? There's not a whole lot of teeth in that then. But you're talking about Breitbart News, right, which is propped up and funded primarily by the billionaire Mercers out of New York City, right, who also are the primary funders of the Trump administration, right, or the Trump campaign, I should say, right. You have that. It's at the Heritage Foundation, right? The original, basically, right? Right wing think tank based out of Washington, D.C., that funds a lot of this stuff. And you've got money pouring in to do this. And, you know, Sam Cedar made a really good point in the podcast when he was interviewing Coppins, when he was saying, like, look, the right looks at developing its media, right, about controlling the media, right, about kind of not just like having an agenda or having some talking points or having a thing, but enacting it, right, and materializing it, right? And so he said it like this. He said, look, they look at, on the right, they look at this as like venture capitalists, right? They look at it and say, okay, look, you've got these 10 people coming to me kind of wanting to set up their own kind of right-wing version, their new right-wing podcast or the new right-wing TV show or the new right-wing publication, right? And you don't really know which one of those things will ultimately succeed, right? They all kind of decent ideas. So what you're going to do is you're going to provide seed money to all 10, right? So here's $100,000 for you. Here's $100,000 for you and right across the board. Right. And then at some point, right, some of those are going to succeed and some of those are going to fail. The person who's doing that investment, right, the person from that right is basically looking at that and saying that's well spent money. The point that Cedar was making, right, and he's made this multiple times on the Majority Report. The point that Cedar was making was that there is no corresponding process on the left. Right. Now, again, yes, we can argue till we're blue in the teeth that, look, you know, there's just not a whole lot of billionaires on the left, right? I said, okay, that's true, right? So yes, there's more billionaires, maybe those, especially people who are ideological billionaires on the right. Okay, even if we give you that, we're not talking about one for one here, right? We're talking about, because look, I mean, part of what gives what makes progressive media different, right, from my view at least, is that your goal, right, is to kind of get more people involved in a process. Right. And to going to be representative to that community. It's not simply about caring about an ideological agenda pushing forward. And there's some people that do that. But what it is, it's trying to be as a corrective at this point, or at least how I see that. It's trying to kind of dig in and kind of bring attention to people's movements when they're trying to kind of, you know, gain justice or, you know, making sure that their health care is not cut, to focus on, you know, the everyday attempts to kind of build resistance. I mean, this is kind of what we do. And because of new media, you don't need like $3 million to buy a printing press or something like this, right? You don't need that, right? You can do it relatively inexpensively. But if you want to sustain those outlets, right, there has to be some sort of investment. Now, whether it's kind of like what we've been trying to do here is to have a membership-based publication, a membership-based podcast, because, you know, I would rather have a lot of people contributing a little bit, becoming a member for like $5 a month or $10 a month, right? And not beholden to any one kind of like angel investor, right? That would be the ideal thing, that the more people that we give in that are saying, hey, yes, we need to invest in our progressive community. We need to invest in our progressive media. So we're going to support this. Why? Because we want to support the progressive movement, right? That's the idea, right? Movements need their voice. Movements need their media. Right. But I don't get why it's so difficult for us to get there. Right. And this is kind of, you know, you think about a lot of liberals, right? If you like a lot of liberals who have money, right? And I don't mean like billionaires, right? But people who are fairly well off, right? You know, like you have professors, you have professionals, you have all these kind of stuff. And it would seem to me like it's just a no-brainer that this is part of what you do, right? If you believe in that kind of progressive way, then you invest in that. So like for me personally, right? I mean, obviously my investment in Raging Chicken Press, but also in Chapo Trap House, also in Majority Report, also in the Rick Smith Show, right? I subscribe to Jacobin. I subscribe to In These Times. I subscribe to The Nation, right? I mean, you know, I invest in those things. I spend the money on things consciously because I want to support those outlets because I think we need them. Right. But it's an uphill battle. I'll tell you that. So we, we'll just keep plugging along. But the right wing is like meticulous about this. I mean, this goes all the way back to the, you know, the Powell memo of 1970s, when they basically said, look, we need capitalism is in danger. So we need to basically invest in taking over our universities and taking over our media. Right. We need to kind of have the ability to generate ideas that support what we believe. And then we have to have a way of distributing those ideas. Right. And that kind of approach, that kind of logic is really scattered and fractured on the left. And, you know, again, there's really good signs moving forward. There's good signs that we see something like Jacobin emerge and kind of gain such ground. But my concern is that this can't happen solely in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. Right. For this to be effective, we have to invest in our community based stuff. Right. So there's this concept that I talk about all the time with Raging Chicken. Right. It's like, look, you want to build relationships with, you know, with journalists that are kind of have a much bigger reach than we do. Right. The goal. And because, look, unless we get a big break and we get a whole bunch of new members or we get some sort of angel investor comes along and say, hey, listen, we want to support what you do. And then we're going to help you do it. Unless that happens, our goal is going to be to kind of like dig in on the stories that we can cover to try to kind of, you know, do the pull no punches muckraking work, but then send that stuff out and connect that up with journalists that have a much larger reach. So we shall break it. We will break the stories. We'll kind of we'll say things in ways that other people won't say them because, you know, they're not supposed to. They're going to lose their access to their, you know, politician or their president or whoever you're talking about. We'll go ahead and break that, and then we'll send it to those people that we've built relationships to in the media, and hopefully that some of that stuff will catch on, right? And I think that's a really good role because the other side of it too as well is you need people who are going to do this work. Right. And nobody gets training in this work. Right. If you go and you study journalism in college, right, you do not learn how to do this kind of work. Right. You learn how to do traditional journalism. Right. And again, that's not to knock that. I think we need that. Right. But right. In a broader democracy, you can't, the facts alone do not win the day. Right. You have to have ways of framing those facts. You have to have ways of kind of putting the stories forward. And people need to be able to see that their voice matters. And what does that mean is that so instead of waiting by the evening news and hoping that you get like a 30-second clip about the protest that you just had. Right. That it's covered in a halfway decent way on that evening news, a one and done thing. What does it look like to actually have a media outlet that's going to be with you? Right. And wants to hear what you have to say and is going to foreground that your story. Right. If the other people, right, if the people in power, they want it, they want in. Well, guess what? They can have their voice too as well. But our goal is to kind of see what's going on in the streets. Right. That's what we need to do. And we need to invest in these outlets. Right. So, yeah, I mean, you might call it all self-serving right here. But I mean, this is why we're pushing so hard to have the membership program. Right. And like literally, you know, like seriously, right now we're like literally almost two members away from hitting our first goal that will allow us to pay our writers more. Right. So in addition to the $50 a month stipend, we'll be able to pay additional $25 per article for up to two more articles. Right. That's that first step. Right. And we've been waiting, trying to get to those two additional members now for a bit. Right. And it's like, you know, I'm saying, well, this should not be that hard. But it is. So, you know, look, I'm up for ideas out there about how we do this. And just as a point of contrast, briefly, I have to say I didn't intend to go into this as long as I just did. But as a point of contrast, let me just give you a couple examples. Right. There was an article in Salon. This was May, I believe. Yeah. It was in May. Article in Salon in May. Right. And it was written by Alex Koch, and it was not Koch, right? Koch. And it says documents reveal a powerful secretive foundation's blueprint for spreading right wing ideology state by state. OK, so that's it. Now, a lot of us, you know, on the left, you've heard of the Koch brothers, right? Koch brothers are kind of like the stars, you know, the evil stars of the right. But those folks who are in education circles are familiar with a place called the Bradley Foundation, right? The Bradley Foundation is based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right? It's a private foundation, and they have been some of the, you know, key funders, right? You know, again, these are, you know, billionaire-backed foundations, key funders of the charter school movement. right? These are the folks that have put together the playbook. So if you basically look at the Koch Brothers Foundations and the American Legislative Exchange Council that puts together model legislation to enact right-wing policies, well, the Bradley Foundation is basically the equivalent of that when it comes to privatizing public schools. Okay, and charterizing them and breaking them up and breaking teachers' unions and all that kind of stuff. Okay, now, so education folks have known that for a while, right? And they've been trying to expose this in terms of Bradley Foundation. But, you know, again, if you're not within if you're not an educator, right? If you're not a teachers' union, you're not going to pay as much attention to this, right? Well, what has happened now with the Bradley Foundation? There was a group that was called Anonymous Poland, right? And they hacked the Bradley Foundation, right? And basically published a whole bunch of internal documents from the Bradley Foundation, and found out that the foundation had received about a $200 million influx of cash in late 2012, and it came from the trust of Caroline Bradley, right? Lynn's the head of the Bradley Foundation, or the founder, and that's Bradley's wife, Lynn's wife, and the Bradley Foundation geared up to fund a network of conservative think tanks, legal centers, candidate recruitment organizations, media outlets, and advocacy groups in 13 states, based on the foundation's successful efforts in Wisconsin. And I was just quoting that from the Salon article, right? So since 2012, 2013, and so on like this, that we've seen the foundation is working to expand all sorts of kind of conservative media sites in primarily some key five states. And so here it is. So, quote, now the foundation is focusing on five states it views as having strong conservative infrastructure, thus making it ripe for a rightward change. The foundation is working to expand conservative power in Colorado, North Carolina, Oregon, Washington, and Wisconsin by funding established networks of right-wing organizations that promote conservatism and help far-right candidates win elections. It's a long-term strategy that, quote, can take decades, according to the longtime CEO of the foundation, Rick Graber, who recently stepped down from his post. Right. So, and here's some examples. Right. So, the Bradley Foundation has recently given large grants to groups in these states, including $575,000 to commit to five organizations in Colorado, two of which aim to, quote, defund teachers' unions and achieve real education reform, unquote. $1.5 million to two groups mostly funded by the Koch brothers, biggest ally in North Carolina, Art Pope, to create, quote, disruptive communications framework, unquote, to amplify conservative news, and another $1.5 million to a group in Washington and a field office in Oregon to, quote, educate union workers themselves about their rights and defund big labor, right? And it kind of goes into this. And so they see these things as connected, right? They, on the one hand, there's an investment in the ideas, right? That's why they put so much money and, you know, basically spent 40 years building up a kind of an alternative ideological ecosystem, basically. And then they said, okay, it's not enough to have the ideas. You need a way to distribute them. So then you're going to invest also in your media infrastructure, right? And then once you invest in that media infrastructure, then you start to kind of thinking about, okay, what's the particular fights that you want to get into this time around and then next time around. In each step of the way, these folks are thinking long term, right? And this is kind of what I'm talking about funding a media infrastructure. Right, is that you actually need to put in money, not look for like an immediate return on your investment, right? Like so many of the Wall Street blokes like to think, but you're trying to kind of create a kind of an alternative network and an alternative ecosystem that basically that is capable, right, of kind of bringing your messages out. And I think for so long the left, or especially the liberal left, has relied upon established institutions like the existing media infrastructure of the Washington Post and New York Times to do that work for them, or for the university systems to do that work for them, as opposed to actually having to think about really building an investment in that. So that's just one example. Another example, and this is one, again, remember Rick and I have talked about this. You have Hillsdale College, right? This is based in Michigan. Hillsdale College is a private college, which is basically, you know, its whole mission is to, educate the next generation of right-wing citizens, really. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. They have Hillsdale College a few years ago basically invested in a place called the Alan P. Kirby Jr. Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship in Washington, D.C. So they basically just got these three row houses, right? They bought all this stuff up. And they basically, it's like an outpost for the college in Michigan, so that people, you know, their students that go down there to kind of work with Republican legislators or work in conservative think tanks have a place to go and have a educational connection there. And this is the mission of the Kirby Center. Okay, quote, America's founders emphasized a citizen education that centered on an understanding of natural rights and thus the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The progressives, beginning in the 19th century, believed that those principles were outmoded. Consequently, they placed their emphasis on educating experts who could manage citizens' lives better, or so they supposed, than the citizens could themselves. With progressivism ascendant in education, unfamiliarity with America's founding principles is now a problem, especially among those who lead our nation. The urgent task, then, is to simply to recover the knowledge that is lost. Accomplishing that, the propositions advanced by both the founders and the progressives are testable by reason and can be compared with real facts in the world. Right? So this is the way. Now, goodness, this is a nonprofit. Well, it's private, but put the stuff forward. They have a center there. They have buildings there that are explicitly meant to do this. And, right, they have an entire media center there, too, as well. Right, they basically built a radio studio in Washington, D.C. from Hillsdale College that they basically make available to conservative talk show hosts to kind of come in and use. Right, they also have a radio station and a media network at Hillsdale College in Michigan, which they help train the next generation of conservative talk radio hosts. Right. These are people who are thinking down the road. They're looking at Rush Limbaugh. They're looking at, you know, Alex Jones, the freak. And that whole kind of conservative talk radio thing, and just saying, look, these folks are going to – they're getting old, right? I mean, they're no longer in their 40s, right? They're no longer in their 30s. Now they're in their 50s and 60s. You know, they're getting up there. So we need to start to investing in that next generation. And this is exactly what they're doing, right? So they got the Boyle Radio Studio down there at the Alan P. Kirby Center for Constitutional Studies down there in Washington, D.C. They've got their training centers up there in Michigan. And then they've got a principle and an agenda that is decidedly kind of libertarian free market, right? There's your next one. And then this is not exactly kind of the investment in media infrastructure, but again, it shows you how these people think, right? So this comes out of, again, this is a... Oops, this is the wrong one. I pulled up the wrong one. So this basically I'll come up with it. So basically, there was I wanted to say it was in Ceylon, but I don't think it was in Ceylon. Hold on just a second. No, I'm not going to be able to come up with it right now. But it's basically what's been happening is that there's been a whole bunch of, again, these same kind of right-wing billionaires who are trying to invest in the future, that there was an expose that came out, I think we want to say March 2017, right? So this is not just brand new. This is not just like brand new breaking news. March 2017, they found out that some of these billionaires were basically, and some of these think tanks were basically funding student government campaigns. Okay? Student government campaigns. All right? So this actually comes from it was originally broken in the Chronicle of Higher Education, but it was there's a story I'm looking at here by Poynter, and it said the title of it is "With a Tip and some FOIA Request, Freedom of Information Act Request, the Chronicle of Higher Education broke open a student government scandal," right? And so this is kind of what it is. So I'm going to read a little bit from it. So just ask Michael Vasquez, a Chronicle of Education higher education reporter who parlayed a tip and a Freedom of Information Act request to break open a story that tracks how a right-wing group is wielding influence by funneling thousands of dollars to candidates for student government. This is an expose, and not from a left-wing website or blogger, but from the Chronicle of Higher Ed, of Charlie Kirk, a frequent Fox News pundit, and his nonprofit Turning Point USA, which is a de facto super PAC for conservative student government campaigns. Why care? Well, some student leaders have had an impact on state legislation. One played a big role in a Colorado outlawing free speech zones on campuses. But Ohio State and the University of Maryland College Park student candidates were outed for violating spending rules. We may have the image of a student government as a high-minded breeding ground for future politicians. This, however, is a tale of corruption and of stealthy attempts to influence. Right? Again, it is the same model. right? They recognize that, okay, look, if college campuses are the one places that we're going to see any kind of progressive foothold and student organizations and stuff, then we got to take it down. How do we take it down? We basically throw money at students to get them to run for student government and to basically get the students behind particular kinds of policies and try to get certain things enacted. And they're doing it, right? It's that kind of investment moving forward. So anyways, so that's my doom and gloom for today, folks. And again, I'm sorry I've gone on so long. I really thought this was going to be a much shorter one. It's still gonna end up shorter than when Sean and I were on. But I want to take a quick break now, and we're going to come back. We're going to do the last call, looking at some space news and some beer. I want to remind everybody that you can become a member of Raging Chicken Press by going to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab. So we'll be back right after this with a little space and beer.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive, activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Welcome back. This is Ken Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, here for the last call. And I wonder what we'll have this week. Well, before I get into the specific space news, that is, have you, that's from the old Star Trek. Have any of you been watching the new Star Trek Discovery? Man, it is good. It is good. And I don't have to look at Sean's face right now, kind of like rolling his eyes at me talking about Star Trek, because he's not here. But it's fantastic. Again, I mentioned in our previous podcast about how Rolling Stone basically said, look, this is the Star Trek for the Trump era. And some of the producers of the show are very explicit about that. Like, not only do you have kind of women and people of color front and center, but they're grappling with, you know, questions of kind of racial purity, right? The Klingons in the new Star Trek are basically, rallying around this extremist who says we want to remain Klingon, right? It's basically like the analog for kind of white supremacy. So we get to see that play itself out over this season. All sorts of kind of ethical issues about to what degree is it okay to kind of, abuse people in order to accomplish an end. Questions about war, it's been great. And, if you see it come up in your Facebook feed or whatever like this, it always says it's visually stunning. And it is, right? It is visually stunning. It's if you're a sci-fi fan, man, it's just great to watch. But the storyline has got me hooked now. So, and I know, it's on CBS All Access, right? Which means I have to pay to watch it. But it also means that's what I'm going to ask for my birthday. If you're gift certificates for those things, get some, hopefully other people will help subsidize my sci-fi watching. But do check it out if you want. I'd love to hear if there's other fans out there To kind of drop us a line, put something in our comments on the Facebook page or on our Podbean site. I'd love to hear what you got to say about that, because it's really, really cool. Quick space news today. I don't know if anybody saw this, but scientists are now saying that they think that there actually is a ninth planet in our solar system. They're calling it a missing super Earth, like whatever. I mean, I think that's kind of more headline grabbing than anything else. But they are saying that this is kind of this hypothetical planet that's about 10 times more massive than Earth. And then it's like way out at the edge of our solar system. Right. But basically, they're, you know, through observations that they're, you know, seeing, say, gravitational pulls on other particular objects, and the through kind of like mathematical equations and things like you're saying, that it's got to be something out there that's pulling on these other objects in a way. Right. So far, they're thinking that it has to be about 20 times farther out from the sun than Neptune is. And like I said, about 10 times more massive than Earth. They haven't found it, but they're looking at it, which is, you know, kind of interesting. And here's the quote from NASA, right? It's a quote. There are now 5 different lines of observational evidence pointing to the existence of Planet Nine. Constantine Badigan, a planetary astrophysicist at the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, said, if you were to remove this explanation and imagine Planet Nine does not exist, then you generate more problems than you solve. All of a sudden, you have 5 different puzzles, and you must come up with 5 different theories to explain them. Right. So, again, that's kind of evidence moving forward. It's just kind of interesting to kind of follow this and see how they're actually kind of making some of these calculations. It's kind of cool to see. The other big news early this morning, like 1 a.m. or something, 1:30 a.m. or something like this, there was 2012 TC4, an asteroid, came pretty close to Earth. And, you know, they know this has come close before, but this was extra close this year. It came to about 26,000 miles above Antarctica at about 1:42 a.m. This is according to space.com. And that's about 11% of the distance between the Earth and the Moon, just beyond the orbit of geostationary satellites. So that's pretty close, right? And it was, well, what do they say, how big this thing was? Of course, I forget about that. I mean, the thing wasn't huge, right? But it's not. It would be too small to. Oh, I know. You know, remember a few years ago there was up in the Soviet Union, northern Soviet Union, there was an asteroid that basically entered the atmosphere and came in as a meteorite, right? So it kind of flamed up. They said it was kind of about the same size as that. So maybe like, you know, 10 to 15 meters big, or like, you know, 30 feet to 50 feet, something in there. So that's an absolutely huge thing, but just kind of a cool thing. The asteroid just flew by to say hi. And this one apparently is going to, you know, this is the second time around. It's going to come back again. So we'll see if it gets closer this next time around. We'll see. How's that? Good news out of Free Will Brewing. If they are releasing today, 2 sours, or two, you know, it's 2 sours. One is called Wild Hack. And I just want to kind of read these for you, because I will do damage to my description if I don't leave you what the what they actually have in their descriptions of this. And this would be the kind of thing, once again, that Shaman just kind of rolls eyes back, say, I can't believe you just, you know, can't get this right. Here is that one is called Wild Hack. It's a Fodra and barrel aged sour brown with blueberries. It comes in about 7.4% alcohol, right? And it's, you know, coming in the 500 milliliter bottles. It's carefully crafted collaborative blend. This is quoting from Free Will Brewing. Carefully crafted collaborative blend with William Reed, Johnny Brenda's, and Standard Taps. Comprised of two and more years of Fodry aged Flemish red, 2-year blueberry sour, and a rum barrel aged red saison. Aromas of blueberries, dark bread, sherry, and port, with deeply complex sour flavors of dark berries, candied plums, currants, and musky oak. A multidimensional sour benefited by the extended aging process. So that's the one. The second one is called Industrio Rustique, Fodry and rum barrel aged funky Belgian style dark ale that comes in at 9.6%, also in the 500 milliliter bottles. And this is, quote, their description. A collaboration with Stickman Brews, Royersford, PA. This beer is a rum barrel and Fodry aged blend of strong saisons and Belgian style quadruple ales. Malty rich but not sweet, with notes of rum raisin, brown sugar, toffee, caramel, vanilla, and tobacco. elements of wild yeast and tart, dark berries in the finish with a pleasant alcohol warming cheers. So that's it. So today at 3 o'clock, both at the their location in Perkasie and up at the Peddler's Village location, they will be releasing these at 3 p.m. today. Been waiting for these a while. I know one of the guys who's who works on the sours there, and he said I ran into him, his daughter and my daughter, they're in the same dance class, and he was saying that they're gonna have some stuff that's coming out soon, but they don't know, right? And he even says the description is that with sours you don't really they're ready when they're ready, right? And he's a guy who was brought in actually to work on the sours and kind of so here you go. So I can't wait to pick some of these things up. If you get a chance, go over to Free Will. They've got, again, every Friday at Free Will, they've got, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, they've got food trucks out there. On Sunday, they got food trucks out there. So with this release, you can be able to kind of come and pick up some awesome, awesome sours. They've got cans that are out there too as well, and stock up for the fall. So there's that. Then the other thing, Sean is not a big fan of pumpkins, like pumpkin beers, right? He always makes fun of me every year. But Pizza Boy, right, a place where he works, is also released a pumpkin sunny side up on Tuesday. That, from what I understand, has got some good spicing in it, like, kind of winter spicing in it, like cinnamon and nutmeg and that kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful. I'm going to probably see Sean later on today. I'm hoping that that he brought me a 4-pack of that so I can kind of check that out. It's only in cans, not on tap. So only in cans, you can pick it up there. So that's it, folks. So this has been kind of quite a ride. It's a bit weird doing this all by myself. And I'm definitely benefit from having someone to talk to instead of just talking out into the into the abyss and hoping that somebody might be listening. But for those of you who have stuck through and have tuned in today, thank you for tuning in. I appreciate it. And if you get a chance, look, if you get your podcast on iTunes or Podbean, whatever like that, leave us a review, leave us comments, right? That's really helpful, especially iTunes reviews. If you leave the iTunes reviews, that helps kind of boost us up in their ratings, gets the, basic, not even just the ratings, but it kind of, puts it on people's radar more. And that's extraordinarily helpful. We had a few people over the past couple of weeks who've added in reviews. Thank you so much for doing that. It's very, very helpful. I'd also encourage you, if you, go to our Facebook page, and this is leave us a review on Facebook page, because we have some right-wing trolls that like to get out there and kind of like try to downgrade our site or kind of write bad reviews of us. So the more that you can kind of contribute and tell people about why it is that, that you dig our Facebook page or our main site at Raging Chicken Press or this podcast, make sure you do. Okay, I'm just going to kind of like settle in and kind of get out of here because if I keep on talking, I don't know what's going to happen. So anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thanks so much for tuning in, and Sean will be back next week. Until then, folks, see ya!